Hello, and thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to a podcast on CelticUnderground.net. I am Harry Brady, and this is podcast number 230.
I thought I saw my mother's eyes on the road to Aberdeen.
I hope you had a good Christmas and are looking forward to your new year. This week, I've got a slightly different guest on the podcast. We're not looking at performance of Ronnie Dyer, Celtic team, or anything else. We are discussing the career, and it's detailed out in his book, Beg to Differ, of Mr. Ali Begg. So it takes him through Celtic TV, Man United TV, Sky Sports, ESPN, Bad Boys Inc., modelling, attempts at a football career, and now, finally, he's in Doha in Qatar. It really is a varied life, so I'll leave it for him to talk about it. His enthusiasm for life, if anything, is fairly evident in this podcast. I'll see you on the other side. This is me, Harry Brady, with him, Ali Begg. So I am joined this week by a very interesting individual. Most of those listening will know him from his time when Celtic TV was available on the Sky platform. He is, and I've got a list the length of my arm to read this out, former model, boy band member, star of Celtic TV, ESPN in Singapore, I think. Is it BIN Sports in...
BN.
BN Sports, Sky Sports, umpty dumpty other things, and an author of Beg to Differ. It is Ali Begg. Mr. Begg, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. What a lovely introduction.
The thing that gets me is, for such a youthful looking man, how can you pack such a lot into such a short period of time?
Oh, listen, we can do these podcasts again. Don't you worry about that. honestly, I don't know. Since writing the book, I've been asked the question many times, how have you been able to do this? And first and foremost, I put it down to a lot of luck, being in the right place at the right time. Plus also, I've been incredibly ambitious throughout my life, and I've always wanted just that little bit more than the norm. I always knew growing up that I wanted to do something different and I wanted to be something different, hence the title of the book, really. But I never knew what path I wanted to go down. I knew from a young age that all I wanted to do was be a professional football player. It's all I wanted to do. And all I wanted to do was play for Aberdeen. No other club existed. I just wanted to play for Aberdeen. And I put all my energy and all my efforts in my youth to improve as a player and improve as a youngster, to try and make that ambition become a reality. So all I wanted to do was become a football player. And when that didn't happen, I had no idea what I wanted to do. Because from an educational point of view, I would say that my education is limited. And I would say that my intelligence is limited. And I just didn't know what I wanted to do. But I always knew, Brian, that I just wanted to be different.
And you certainly have pegged out a different life. So you said not very intelligent, which I'm sure you're doing yourself down because you wouldn't be a disservice, because you wouldn't be able to be where you are without being intelligent. But I'm sure what you were maybe hinting at was, did you maybe not excel at school? Is that really the point?
Yes. Yeah, I couldn't study. I always had problems studying. Whenever I was told to do homework, I didn't want to do homework. I wanted to be playing football with my pals out in the street. I couldn't concentrate at work because all I was thinking about was getting to Pittodrie to watch a game or getting to the ground to train. Yeah. Or when I was playing boys club football. All I was looking forward to was training and playing. It's all I was interested in doing. And I just had no interest in school whatsoever. And I know that's wrong. And looking back, it was wrong. And maybe a better education would have opened many doors or other doors, let's say. But I chose my own path, and not that I'm detracting in education, but I believe that I formed my own path through my own ambition, not so much through the through my education system and through the qualifications that I gained. Saying that, I do, of course, implore youngsters these days to get an education, because it will open many doors. And it's now that I've got a little man myself in my life, his education is very important to me and his upbringing is very important to me. So, yeah, get an education.
So you were about, say, eight through to about 14, 15 in the real glory days of Aberdeen and the Fergie.
Yeah, we moved to Aberdeen from Holland in 1979. And my father was a big football fan. He supported Clyde when he was growing up, because my grandfather, who was a football journalist based out of Glasgow before he died, also supported Clyde. Third Larnach was his team.
Right.
And then Third Larnach folded, obviously. And then he started supporting Clyde. So my dad was always a Clyde fan growing up. So when we moved to Aberdeen, he had a reason to support another team. And he would wax lyrical around the breakfast table in the morning before he went to work and we went to school about this team that had just won the Scottish Championship. And by that time, I was becoming aware of football, and I was becoming intrigued and interested by it. So I suppose we moved to Aberdeen just at the right time, because it was when Aberdeen really started to, and I know I get a bit of stick for this, but started to dominate Scottish football. So I was very fortunate. I grew up when Aberdeen basically won everything that there was to win. And for me, winning was just part of the norm. Hence why the past 30 years has just been disaster after disaster. But now that something special is on the horizon, and I do believe something special is on the horizon, I've been propelled back to my youth. I really have. I'm like a kid again. It's unbelievable the feelings that I have from a football club that I haven't had for so many years. And I just feel like a big kid. I really do. I go to bed excited. You know, I look forward to the games again. I can't wait for 3 o'clock. And, you know, my wee boy gets bathed. He gets put to bed early so that I can get to my PC and sit down in front of my PC, and I get my household chores done and make sure that Miriam's happy and, you know, the dishes are done, so that I can just sit down and enjoy the game. And it's just a great feeling. It really is a great feeling.
There's nothing better than supporting a football team, and then when your football team starts to give you hope.
Yeah, and it is hope. It's all about hope. You know, we've been clinging on to hope for 30 years. Yes, we've had a little bit of success along the way, which has been nice. But the feelings as an adult are not the feelings that I had as a child. Because as I mentioned, to me, winning was part of my childhood. I didn't experience anything else. I never understood losing. I didn't understand the concept of losing, because we never lost.
Yeah.
And when we did, it was a very strange feeling, and I wasn't ready for it. So as I matured as a, you know, from a teenager into an adult, is when Aberdeen, you know, obviously started to basically lose track of what Sir Alex Ferguson had done after Sir Alex moved on. Yes, we had some cup finals to enjoy, Scull Cup finals and the odd Scottish Cup success here and there. But from a league point of view, it was gone. Mm-hmm. It was very strange all of a sudden as a fan not being used to that level of success and not enjoying the amount of success that we used to enjoy, and going to Pittodrie, and just everything was different. There wasn't the same feeling. There wasn't the same atmosphere. It wasn't the game, the European games that we used to enjoy. And it just kind of petered away. So now that it's back, it's becoming very exciting again.
Well, we can get back to Aberdeen in a minute. When did you realise that you weren't going to make it as a footballer? Because were you at Blackpool and Burnley for trials?
Trials of Blackpool and Burnley when I was, oh gosh, what age was I? 15. So I'd gone through the Scotland schoolboy trials, mm-hmm. Which basically meant that because I was an unsigned player, you had to go through a number of trials as a schoolboy. And the first one being your county, your region, your city. So I went through the Grampian trials. I went through the Aberdeen City trials. And then you have to go through the North of Scotland trials. And then I think the final trial before you were invited to Largs, which is where Scotland's headquarters were at the time in the sort of mid to late 80s, you had to play a game against the boys from Dundee and Edinburgh. Right. So when I was 15, I represented the North. I captained the North of Scotland after making it through all these trials.
What position
were you in? But I always played the first year when I was 15. No, sorry, when I was 14, I played centre back. And then the following year when I was 15, I played right back. But I always failed the Dundee and Edinburgh trial, and I never got through that trial. So I never made it to Largs, and I was always hugely disappointed. And by that time, Aberdeen had already sort of come on board and had invited me to training. So I used to train on a Thursday night, Tuesday and a Thursday night with Aberdeen when I was a youngster. But again, I wasn't good enough, and I knew I wasn't good enough. Mm-hmm. I knew, you know, the step up when I played against these boys that represented the Dundee and the Edinburgh district. And then when I started training with the pick of the boys from the Aberdeen area, who by that time, most of them were already signed on schoolboy forms, it was a massive step up, and I knew I wasn't good enough. And I knew also I didn't have the mental toughness, and I also don't think I had the physical toughness. Looking back, you know, 35 years ago now, that I know that now, but I didn't know it then. Mm-hmm. You know, in hindsight, as we know, is a wonderful thing, and I sometimes wish that I had more maturity, let's say, as a 15 and a 16-year-old. Because I think if I'd had a bit more maturity, I think I might have done better. Selvey.
But isn't that why some players like Paul Lambert and Dan Jackson, if I think from a Celtic perspective, were not considered fantastic players, but in the second half of their career were able to play for Celtic? It's because they had the maturity to work out what they could and couldn't do, and just played to the made the best of what they had.
I got to know a guy, you know, Pat Rice, that used to be Arsene Wenger's.
Yes, uh-huh.
I got to know when I was living in London. I played a lot of charity football for the Arsenal ex-pros and celebrity football team, and I lived in a small village not far from London Colney. So I used to go down and watch the training a lot. And I used to speak to Pat quite a lot about young players. And I got to know a good friend of mine was a guy called David Court, who up until recently was Liam Brady's assistant at the youth development at Arsenal Football Club. And David used to play for Arsenal in the 60s and became a very good friend of mine because we lived in the same village. So we always traveled to the games together. And I always used to pick his brain at what do you have to do to make it as a player, and what do you have to do to sustain a good career? And David said to me, as did Pat, it's about your work ethic and it's about your attitude to the game. Your attitude to the game has got to be absolutely spot on. You can have as much God-given talent, but it's your attitude that carries you through. And it's also understanding your own ability. Mm-hmm. And it's the understanding of your own capabilities which makes you get through 90 minutes of football. Now, David was in his 50s, and he was playing, okay, it's charity football, but it's mm-hmm. still football.
Yeah.
And he's playing boys who are 20, sometimes 30 years younger than him. So he knew his capabilities. So all he used to do in these charity games was collect the ball, knock it on, move into space. Collect the ball, knock it on, move into space. Mm-hmm. And you could tell that he used to be a professional player because he would just move, pass, move, pass, move, pass. And I think guys like Paul Lambert and Darren Jackson that you use as an example, they knew their capabilities. They knew what their strengths were. No doubt they knew what their weaknesses were. And that's all they offered to Celtic. They offered their strengths to Celtic. And I think that's what, you know, players that are now maturing, you know, there's so many that we can name, but we don't have time to go through them all. They know their limits. They know their capabilities. And longevity to me is attitude, fitness, and maturity.
So you didn't have the maturity at 15, 16
no.
to perhaps find and carve out a niche for yourself. So what made you then decide, well, if I'm not going to be a professional footballer, I'm going to be a model? It's not an obvious choice, that's what I'm asking.
At the time, it was my first real blow in life, and I had to deal with it. Now, I think, even though I didn't have the maturity as a player, I think I had the maturity as a teenager to be able to pick myself up. I knew that I had to pick myself up. Obviously, with the help of my parents, who were very supportive. My father in particular was very supportive. He'd been through a lot of blows from a business point of view. So he knew how to pick yourself up, get over the hurdles and move on. Because if you're not careful, and I've taken this attitude all the way through my life, if you're not careful, you will allow the disappointments to drag you down. And it's important not to allow disappointments to get a hold of you. You have to move on in life. You get one shot at life. You have to move on and you have to make the best of it. So when I didn't make it, I thought to myself, right, pick yourself up, dust yourself down, and go again. And it just so happened that I was in a fortunate position where, believe it or not, where I used to get my hair cut in Aberdeen, they used to attend the Scottish Hair Show every year. And they asked me if I'd be interested in being a model for the hair show, right? So I can hear all your listeners killing themselves laughing now. So down we go to Edinburgh. What's it called now? The big hall. It completely escapes my mind.
Usher Hall.
Usher Hall, yes. And we did the hair show. And what, you know, show business, you know, extravaganza, walking down a catwalk and giving it the full shebang. And it just so happened that I got spotted by a Japanese modeling agency. And she got in touch with me and she asked me to travel down to London. And if I could get a few photographs taken. So I got a few photographs taken by a good friend of mine who's a fantastic photographer in Aberdeen called Ray Smith. And Ray took some photos of me. And I went down to London and she wanted me to become part of this agency. She wanted me to sign up. But she wanted me, first and foremost, to get into an agency in London so that I could get some work. So I spent a week in London with a friend of mine who was already signed to an agency in London called Models One, and he was moving down to attend university. Mm-hmm. And I literally went around every single modeling agency in London, handed them my photographs, and just basically tried to blag my way into a modeling agency. And after all seemed failed and lost, the very last agency that we went to on the list was called Lorraine Ashton IMG, and they took me on. Mm-hmm. And so I moved to London with my pal Martin, and started modeling and just randomly started a portfolio, started to get better. And then just by pure luck, I got spotted by a scout from Models One, which was one of the most renowned agencies who, believe it or not, had already been in to see. And they had turned me away because I was too wee. They said I was too small. So they said to me, if you can wear boots with big heels, we'll sign you on. And they did. So for 18 months, I used to wear big biker boots so that I could look 6 foot and not 5 foot 10 and a half.
Actually, from that point on, whilst it's not obvious how the steps, from that point on, I can sort of see how your career can start to move the way that it did. Because from that point on, which was the early 90s, you joined Bad Boys Inc., a boy band, which makes sense, the way the boy bands were getting formed at that time, in terms of they were looking for people who looked the part as much as sang the part.
Yeah. Oh, it was all about looking the part. Trust me, it was nothing to do with singing the part.
So Bad Boys Inc., when I Googled them, because that was 92 to 95 they were in, when I have no memory of them, but when I Googled them, they did seem that you had success.
We had reasonable success. We should have had a lot more success. But we actually, considering the music that was being produced on our behalf, I actually thought we did okay. Because to me, the whole thing, it's only been in the past few years that I've actually been able to look back on it with a great deal of fondness. Mm-hmm. I've written the chapter in the book about it to try and explain to people what it was all about. I've tried to put a football spin to the story, but I have tried to explain to people, first of all, why I did it, mm-hmm. and what I gained from the whole experience. But for many, many years, I shied away. People wanted to talk to me about it. I would turn away. I didn't want to know. I didn't want to talk about it. It left a very bitter taste in the mouth. It left me not, I wouldn't go as far as saying it left me broken, but it left me in a very, very bad way. From a personal point of view, definitely from a financial point of view, and from a career point of view, it almost destroyed me. Mm-hmm. But again, as we talked about earlier, when I was released by Aberdeen, I would say at this time I had courage. I had to really dig deep to come away from it, to reinvent myself and try and build a new career for myself. And I knew it was going to take a few years, and I knew it would take hard work on my part, a lot of soul searching, a lot of bridges to be built, to be able to form the type of career that I now currently have. Because as much as the experience was unbelievable, and I'm extremely fortunate, I don't want people to think that I'm not grateful for the experience, because I know there's millions of people out there who are far more talented than I am that would give their right arm to be able to experience what I experienced. So from that point of view, I do not want people ever to think that I'm not grateful for the experience. I am unbelievably grateful for the experience. And now, looking back, 20 years on, it was a phenomenal 3.5-4 years of my life. I traveled the world. I performed in front of tens of thousands of screaming fans. I was on Top of the Pops, for goodness sake. Top of the Pops, I sometimes have to pinch myself to really believe that I performed on Top of the Pops 4 times. And we had a top 10 album and I had a top 10 record. It beggars belief. It really does, that I was able to go through that experience, perform at the London Palladium in front of royalty, appear on the most incredible television shows. We did the first ever National Lottery show, the first band ever to appear on the National Lottery show. So now I can really look back on it and actually be quite proud of what we achieved, considering what I believed, in a humble opinion, was an horrendous music. It was just, to me, it was awful. And I was embarrassed by it. As were my colleagues. Trust me when I tell you, as were my colleagues. We were not happy with it. So for us to be actually able to achieve the amount of success that we did with that sound, I actually thought we did okay.
But to be fair, people sometimes, and I can understand your point about hiding away from admitting you're part of it, and people will be dismissive and critical of the type of band you were in and the type of music they do. Mm. But we all make compromises in life to have the standard of living that we want. How many people listening to this podcast will hand on heart say, yeah, I love my job and I would do it for free, and it's exactly what I've ever dreamed that I would be doing to earn a living for myself?
It's not many.
No, exactly. And it's a job that you did. And the reason why I said earlier about I can see from what you've described and from your CV where the connection is, the positives for you that I can see from our conversation, you have a very strong self-belief and self-will and self-confidence, which will help you through that rejection. But my perception is that through what you've just described, at least you got a great insight and understanding into how that world works and how the media world works. And if you have the positive attitude to be able to take things of that, my perception is that's what gave you the key to open the door to the career that you subsequently had.
Absolutely. I would not be sitting here now talking to you if it wasn't for Bad Boys Inc. Mm-hmm. And I know that. And I now appreciate that. But as I said, it's taken me 20 years to understand that. Because people have to remember, I was 22 years old when the band split up. I was left in financial dire straits. I was betrayed by the people who I thought were there to look after us. I felt there was an agenda, and I couldn't understand why all of a sudden, when it looked like we were on the periphery of being really, really successful, and it was just taken away from us, and the people that were there to look after us, in my opinion, didn't give a monkey's about us as four young individuals. David was 21 years old, Tony and I were 22, and Matthew was 23 years old, and we were left to fend for ourselves, and nobody cared. And I just didn't understand the coldness behind that decision. It left me bitter. And it left me confused, it left me agitated, and it left me very, very angry. And for many years, I resented the very people that I believed were there to look after us. And all my anger and frustrations was taken out on these people. And again, I was left in a situation where I had no choice but to pick myself up. I had no choice but to crack on with my life. And I remember, and I can still see myself. There was one morning, I got out of bed and I said to myself, Ali, you have to crack on. The phone is not going to ring. You have to make it happen yourself. When I left the band, I expected the phone to ring. Mm-hmm. I expected the hangers-on to remain hanging on. They didn't. They moved on. The phone stopped ringing. Nobody was interested in Bad Boys Inc. And nobody particularly was interested in Ali Beg, apart from my very close friends and my immediate family. So I had no choice but to pick myself up and go again at the age of 22. And see, trying to get a job, it almost proved impossible to get a job. And I swear to you, on my father's grave, I went into a well-known sports shop to try and get a job because I was getting that desperate for money. I went in and I filled out an application, and the lassie said to me, I can't employ you. You're a famous pop star. And it was soul destroying, absolutely soul destroying, until eventually I was able to get a job in a small gym in a hotel just on the outskirts of London where nobody knew me. Mm-hmm. And I was able to pick myself up, sort myself out financially, and go again.
Did you get an explanation? How did they break the news that everything was finished?
Well, I left the band. Right. That's why we finished. That's why we split up. To cut a very long and laborious and quite boring story short, we were signed to our producer's record company. That record company was signed to the major label, A&M Records. Mm-hmm. Now, we had a 5-album deal with our producer.
Yep.
Now, for the second album, A&M Records wanted us to sign to them direct. Mm-hmm. We had, behind our producer's back, gone to other producers and written tracks and recorded tracks, which would have taken us to another level. It really would. It would have opened many, many doors. And I believe, and I still believe to this day, it would have catapulted us to bigger success. But unfortunately, the producer decided in his own mind, he did not want any other producer working on the Bad Boys Inc. album. So even when he was offered an executive producer's title, he was not for budging. He wanted full control, not just of the artistic nature of the band, but he also wanted full control of us. And I just was not having it. And A&M Records decided to drop us as an act. And I fully endorse that decision, and I fully understand that decision, because they were not going to spend another £750,000 on an album that was going to stiff. Mm-hmm. Now, our first album stiffed, and I know this sounds perverted, and I know some people may not understand this, but I'm glad that it did, because it gave us the ammunition to go to our producer and say to him, it's not working. Mm-hmm. You have to give us the freedom to experiment with different sounds. And he was not for budging. So after A&M Records dropped us, even though we were offered other record deals, we were still stuck in a contract with our producer. By that time, I'd had enough and I wanted out. Plus also, I was not enjoying it. Mm-hmm. I was just sick to the back teeth of what we were doing. And I just had enough. I'd really had enough. I just wasn't enjoying it. And I wanted out, hence why I left the band when I did. And subsequently, the band split up not long after I left.
So you got the job in the gym, in the hotel. So that's a stark contrast from going on tours, playing in front of people and being put up in a hotel to being one of the guys who works in a hotel.
Yeah.
At what point did you decide, I'm going to try and get back into the media world and that's the career that I want to be in?
Well, I didn't actually want to get into the media. I wanted somehow, and I didn't know in what capacity, I wanted to work in football. Mm-hmm. So I studied to become a SFA qualified coach, which I did. So I managed to get my C license. I studied to become a fitness instructor and a sort of an aerobics instructor. And I just knew that somewhere, somehow, I want to work in football. But I don't know how to achieve that. And then just out of the blue, a friend of mine who was working for a shopping channel out of Liverpool called me one morning when I was in the gym and said to me, look, we sell a lot of health and fitness equipment, and we desperately need somebody who is a health and fitness expert mm-hmm. to come on the channel and explain to the viewers how to use the equipment and why, and more importantly, why they're using it. So I thought, this sounds interesting. So I went up to Liverpool, where the shopping channel was based, and I did a screen test for them, and they stuck me on air with my pal. And all of a sudden, and I can't explain this, I have no words to explain it. It just felt right. I was comfortable, I was enjoying it, and I just felt, this is what I want to do. Mm-hmm. I can see myself doing this, and I think I can forge a career in television. So I studied television. So when I was not on air on the shopping channel, I would go behind the scenes and I would watch. So I would sit in the gallery and I'd watch how it was done. I would sit with the producers and I would watch how they would put the program together. And all of a sudden, I just immersed myself in television, mm-hmm. but predominantly football. So I'd watch every single football show on television to get an understanding of what they were doing, but more importantly, why they were doing it. So from there, I got a call from MUTV. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, I find myself doing exactly what I'd been looking to do since I left the band, working in football.
And not only that, but as an Aberdeen fan, to then get to my MUTV and get to speak to Sir Alex Ferguson must have been just fantastic.
It was nothing but a joy. I did not have to think twice when the contract was put in front of me. Now, trust me when I tell you, the contract was basic. And the wage was very basic, considering I had a rough idea of what television presenters were earning. It was very, very basic. But honestly, I couldn't give a jot. For me, it was my step onto a ladder. It was forgive the cliches, but it was the opening of a door. Mm-hmm. So for me, it was like, Ali, you take this. You absolutely grasp this with both hands. This is your opportunity to, again, reinvent yourself and do what you've always wanted to do, which is work in football. So all of a sudden, here I am, finding myself at the Cliff training ground on the second day of my employment at Manchester United Television, waiting for Sir Alex Ferguson to walk through the door and having heart palpitations as he walked through the door, because I hadn't seen him in many, many years. And my grandfather and him were very, very good pals. And again, I've told the story in the book, and I'm not sure if you're aware of it or if some of your listeners are aware of it, but my grandfather was very friendly with a guy called Mr. Todd, mm-hmm. who was the chairman of St. Mirren in 1974. And Mr. Todd phoned my grandfather and said to him, "I need a name. I'm looking for a new manager, and I want your advice. I want an upcoming young manager who I can't pay very much. Who do you recommend?" And my grandfather gave him the name of Alex Ferguson. Mm-hmm. So the next thing we know, Alex Ferguson is the manager of St. Mirren, and we all know where we went from there. So I would like to think that my grandfather had a helping hand in Sir Alex Ferguson's career, and Sir Alex Ferguson has never forgotten that.
Right.
So when, obviously I'd met Sir Alex as a youngster when I was at Aberdeen, when I trained with Aberdeen, and when I was with my grandfather at cup finals and in the press box and all that kind of stuff. So, but to actually meet him as an adult was just, was completely different to meeting him as a kid, especially in the professional capacity that all of a sudden I found myself in. So he came over, and honestly, I was physically shaking. And my co-presenter, she digged me in the ribs and told me to behave myself, which actually helped calm me down. And he came over and he shook my hand and he introduced himself as if he would have to do that. And so I introduced myself back, and he went, Beg. He says, "Yeah, I know that name." And I said to him, "Yeah," I said, my grandmother's asking after you." And who's your grandmother? And I explained who she was. And then I went on to explain who my grandfather was. And honestly, he stopped in his tracks. He asked his assistant to go and get us a cup of tea. Mm-hmm. And we sat down for 10 minutes before the interview and chatted to me about my grandfather and how fond he was of my grandfather and what a great man he was. And it was, I believe, well, I'd like to think that it was the catalyst for our relationship during our time with MUTV. Because whenever I saw him, he would always take time to come over, say hi, how you doing, offer advice, constructive criticism, and just natter about Aberdeen and my grandfather and my uncle. My uncle's a football journalist as well, who recently retired, and he knows my uncle well. And we would just wax lyrical about my grandfather and the old days and Aberdeen. And it was just, it was a treat. And it was just... Again, I've tried to explain it on paper. I was simply living a dream. And when he found out that my father died, he wrote to me, and his closing words on that letter, which will remain private, but the closing line said, "Do not change." Now, for me, that is the biggest and best compliment that I've ever had, apart from the day that my wife said she would marry me.
Now, Club TV's channels are nice, friendly, cozy things. So you're not in the same confrontational mode that you might be in other things, but yeah. You talked about, obviously, the good things there about Sir Alex Ferguson. Was there any occasion where an interview didn't go so well? I'm thinking particularly Roy Keane. He's famous for his stare. Was everything a joy to do the whole time you're at Man U TV?
It wasn't easy. I have to be honest. I wasn't quite ready for the barrage of abuse that I received when I first started presenting on MUTV. And it was, we'll get onto it later. It was the same at Celtic TV. Because look, let's be honest, here's a former boy band member mm-hmm. who's not even a Manchester United fan presenting their channel.
Yeah.
So I was a new broadcaster. I'm not a journalist, and I want people to understand that. I'm not a journalist, and there's a big difference between being a journalist and a broadcaster. Mm-hmm. always saw myself as a broadcaster, but there's journalism in my blood, obviously because of my grandfather and my uncle. So from an editorial point of view, I'd like to think that I do have a very good understanding of what is news. But club channels are very, very different. You have to adhere to the rules. Mm-hmm. You have to. The football club, quite rightly so, has editorial control over what goes out on the channel. So there's a fine line. Now, for me, there's a very fine line between insulting the intelligence of the fan, but also not insulting the members of the playing squad and the backroom staff. Mm-hmm. Very, very important. For the club channels to be successful, you need A, the manager on board, B, the players on board, and C, the owners on board. You must have those three on board. Otherwise, you are not going to have a successful club channel, because ultimately, they dictate the amount of content that you're able to put on a club channel. Mm-hmm. So whenever I interviewed the players, I always briefed them about what I was going to talk about and what I was going to ask them, and if they were uncomfortable with any questions that I was going to ask them. Now, the first time I interviewed Roy Keane was the Monday after he got sent off against Newcastle United at St James's Park when he threw a punch at Alan Shearer. Now, I fully expected, as did my colleagues, for him not to turn up. But to his great credit, he turned up for that interview. Mm-hmm. And I thought, holy crap, how am I going to get through this? Especially when we get to the incident. So I said to him, are you happy to talk about it? And he just stared at me. Didn't give me an answer. He just stared at me. So I thought, right. Now, I have to say, he was unpleasant. Just before we rolled the cameras, there was no, how are you? How's your family? How are you getting on? Nothing. He's just not interested in small talk at all. So I thought, I need to lighten his mood. I need to try and be humorous. So when we got to the incident, I said to him, Roy, for goodness sake, if you're going to punch him, at least punch him properly, eh? And it seemed to lighten his mood. Mm-hmm. And from there on in, he was actually fabulous. Now, I interviewed Roy three times, twice at MUTV, once at Celtic. To interview him, he is nothing but a joy. He's just fascinating. But as a person, I'm not his biggest fan.
Right.
I just find him rude. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've been brought up with manners. And if somebody holds a door open for you, the least you can say is thank you.
Yeah.
And I've held many doors open for Mr. Keane, and not once has he ever thanked me. And I just find it rude. And if you say good morning to somebody in the morning, at least you can expect is a good morning back. Mm-hmm. Not that nod of the head where the person loses their last vertebrae at the top of their neck and their head falls forward. I can't stand that. Just say good morning. I just never understood it. I never understood it. And I still don't, and I think it's unnecessary, and I just think it's plain rude. No need. Just be nice. Just be nice, you know?
He does seem a very complicated individual. It's probably the most diplomatic way to put it.
Yeah, he is very complicated. But who am I to try and figure out who Roy Keane is? You know, again, I try to write about it in the book. I was uncomfortable. You know, I was very fortunate when I was at Celtic that I went through quite a few knee operations, and Mr. Strachan very kindly gave me the use of the club facilities and the medical staff to see me through. And I shared a gym with Mr. Keane on more than one occasion, and he made it quite clear that I should not be in the gym at the same time as him. And I did try and leave. I know my place. I know when I should not be in the player's domain. And I went to get up and hit the showers and head back to the office. And all the medical staff said to me, do not move until you're finished, which was incredibly humbling, you know, from my point of view. I don't get it. You know, for me, he's fabulous to interview. If you ask me to put my top five all-time great players together, he would be in it. What a football player. But my God, is he rude.
But do you know what you're saying there? You know your place. Whether he's the Pope, the Queen, a player for Man United, Celtic, Rangers, Aberdeen, whoever, he's a human being and so are you.
Agreed. Totally agree. And I actually said that in my book. I've actually written that line. I said, at the end of the day, he's only a human being.
So we'll talk about Celtic and MUTV because they're both very similar principles at the time. It must be quite challenging because, as you said, the fans expect, again, getting back to a point I made earlier. In fact, I spoke to someone recently, and we spoke about this before I came on the podcast, who owns a football club. And he was telling me that sometimes it's not a great idea, or sometimes there's a benefit in having people within your football club who are not fans of the team. Because when the team loses, the next day they can do the job that everybody needs to do the next day. Whereas if they're a fan, they sometimes could get embroiled in the problems of the defeat like every other fan. However, fans don't always see it like that.
You've hit the nail on the head. And I believe that what gave me over the edge over some of my co-presenters is that I was not a fan of Manchester United and I was not a fan of Celtic, which meant that my judgment was never, ever clouded. I remember once having a rather heated debate with Arthur Alveston once. And I told him that I actually preferred when Manchester United lost on a Saturday or a Sunday or a midweek game, because it made our shows far more interesting. Because we used to do a lot of phone-in shows on MUTV after a game. And if United lost, we would be inundated with calls from fans. And it made for much more compelling viewing than just a run-of-the-mill, well, United won 2-0 today and Ruud van Nistelrooy scored two goals.
Yeah.
That's it. And there's not much else to say. It was a great performance. We're still top of the league.
Yeah.
And we've got these games to come. If they got beat, my God, the natives were unbelievably restless. And it made, for me, it made great television. All I was interested in doing was making good television. Believe it or not, entertaining television. And I took that same attitude into Celtic TV. At the end of the day, it's only TV. TV show business. Show business is entertainment. Let's not forget that. And it used to annoy me when we used to get far too serious about things on MUTV and Celtic TV, especially when Dominic Diamond was banned. What a nonsense that was. It was the most entertaining show we ever did on Celtic TV. And he got banned because he expressed an opinion of the fans. But you have to be careful. And I understand that. You know, I got into trouble a couple of times because, you know, I made a couple of remarks about players' abilities and players' attitude and all that kind of stuff. And I learned my lessons very quickly. And I, you know, even today, I regret the comments that I made. They were very much tongue-in-cheek. And I regret stuff that I said on Celtic TV. Of course I did. But if you don't learn from these things, you'll never, ever improve. So you have to be careful. You must be careful. Otherwise, it's just not going to work.
But isn't that the very problem? I know Celtic at the moment have looked at reintroducing a stronger Celtic media entity.
Yeah.
And the whole problem with it is, it's, as you pointed out, it's paid for by the club. To get people to watch it and listen to it, it has to be entertaining and it has to have merit, editorial merit in its own right.
Yes.
So
yes.
To have editorial merit in its own right, you have to say, in the modern context, is Van Gaal getting it right at Man United or is Ronnie Dyla getting it right at Celtic? But also equally, if you go on there and slaughter Ronnie Dyla, quite rightly Ronnie Dyla would kick down the door of Peter Lawwell and saying, what are we doing paying for an employee of this club to criticise me?
It's of course.
And so it must be a real difficult tightrope to walk.
It was. I got my first experience of that after the Dominic Diamond incident. You know, when I asked him the question, tell me your thoughts on Celtic's season so far, and he went off on one about if he doesn't play Aidan McGeady for the rest of the season, he should be sacked. If he plays Alan Thompson and Rad Douglas one more time, he should be sacked. If we don't win the league, he should be sacked. Now, my jaw hit the deck and I knew that stuff was going to hit the fan. And Jim Craig's colour drained out of his face. But then all of a sudden, it just dawned on me, hang on a minute. This is a fan. This is a passionate fan. And he's entitled to his opinion.
Yeah.
Now, if it means that he's going to insult the people in question on their own club TV channel, then for half an hour, so be it. Because to me, it was entertaining. Mm-hmm. It was interesting. And it, for me, it opened doors to other discussions. And Jim went back at him. And to Jim's great credit, tried to save the day from a Celtic point of view. For me, all I had to do was sit back and let the two of them go at it. I never said a word for half an hour. It was the easiest show that I ever did because it was utterly compelling. It really was. And I'll argue till I'm blue in the face. It was the best TV program that we made on Celtic TV in the 3.5 years that I was there. It was utterly brilliant. But the next day, oh my God, let me tell you, I was down at Celtic Park and I walked into the main reception and the two doormen, John and John, just shaking their heads at me. Tut, tut, Ali, you're in big trouble, big man. And as the players slowly made their way into the ground, Alan Thompson and Chris Sutton walked past me and didn't even acknowledge that I was there. Rab Douglas gave me the look to end all looks. And then I was like that, oh, geez, I'm in a lot of trouble here. And
but you weren't even the guy that said it.
I wasn't. But the problem is, you see, I'm the face of the channel. Uh-huh. Now, I'm not trying to blow smoke up my own backside when I'm saying that, but I was, which meant it's up to me to direct the conversation and to support the football club and to defend the football club at all costs. Mm-hmm. That was my job.
Yeah.
And to be fair, that's the call. And I knew that was the call. But that night, I thought, no, tonight these guys can go at it because this is good. So when John Robertson walked in with a huge grin on his face and said to me, you're in a whole world of shit, big man. which did not exactly do much for my already nervous mood. He said, Martin's looking for you. I was like, oh, no. But he said to me, look, Al, he says, don't worry about it. He said, just let him have his say and then it'll blow over. So don't worry about it. Stevie Walford walked in and was just laughing his ass off. Because I knew Stevie, because I used to play football with Stevie for the Arsenal boys. So uh-huh. I knew Stevie quite well. He just walked past laughing his ass off. And then Martin walked in and was like, in my office. I was like, oh, God. And he dragged me into his office and he tore strips off me. Mm-hmm. He really did. Constructively, he tore strips off me. And in the end, we actually ended up smiling, shaking hands and moving on, but that was a nervous morning, let me tell you.
But wouldn't that in some ways, in controversial times when you've got, instead of the famous board's vote of confidence, if the fans are given a manager a hard time, I can think of,
for example,
Newcastle, wouldn't it be for riveting club TV if a fan got to come on and vent his spleen at Alan Pardew, for example, or Newcastle TV, and Alan Pardew defended his position because the fan would be saying what all the fans in the stands are moaning about. And Alan Pardew would get, if Alan Pardew believes he's right and the fans are wrong, Alan Pardew would get to directly address all the points that people want to make. And if he can't address them, then he's doing something wrong.
But do you honestly think that a manager would do that?
No, because the managers and people in football, and this gets back to something again we were touching on before in the podcast, the people involved in football forget something that you said. It's entertainment. In fact, to use a phrase that the WWE use, not that I watch it, but it's sports entertainment. And too many people in football think don't understand that for the rest of us who have 9-to-5 jobs, Monday to Friday. The Saturday is our leisure entertainment time.
Mm.
And their job is to be part of, yes, it's a job for them, and I understand that. But part of their job should be, why is it all right for someone to go on X Factor trying to become famous, to get public, to have to deal with public criticism, or a politician to have to deal with public criticism, but a football manager's not?
Mm. I would love to have Martin come on Celtic TV more. I would love to have sat down with him and asked him the questions that I believe the fans wanted answers to. I was never given that opportunity. We, as a club channel, were never given that opportunity. I don't think Martin was interested in Celtic TV from day one. I don't think it was sold to him properly. I don't think he fully understood the concept of what we were trying to do. I believe to him, it was just another media outlet that he had to put up with. Because when Gordon came in, Gordon fully understood what we were doing, and he was on board from day one. Hence why I was able to sit down with Gordon every single Friday morning for half an hour to discuss those week's topics. And he even, out of his own time, came into our studio halfway through the first season to talk to the fans on our TikTok show. Now, I think it's down to the individual. I agree with you. I would love to see more fan, manager, player interaction. But I don't know if the people that make the decisions, as in PR, marketing, have the balls to allow them to do it. Because I think if you spoke with an individual, as in a player or a manager, and sold them the idea without going to a PR person, I think they'd be up for it. Mm-hmm. I really do. It's the PR people that's your problem, because you've got to go through them first. And if you say to a PR person, right, let's get the manager in and let's have a debate with a fan, they'd be like, not a chance.
But you know, you're a professional in the media, so you've got the backing of somebody else paying your wages in a different environment. If somebody almost wants to punch your lights out, actually, in an independent TV, if you're working for BN Sports or Sky or ESPN or whoever, your producer might actually like that confrontation. So you can ask an aggressive confrontational question. But you know, I mean, I've been in the presence of Celtic managers and Celtic executive teams, and I will speak one way to my friends in the Dominic Diamond style of, if he plays him one more time, he should get sacked.
Mm.
When an ordinary fan gets in that environment, it's only a certain type of individual who would not temper their language when they were in the presence of the manager of their club.
Mm.
So an ordinary fan would actually say, instead of, if McGeady doesn't play and Thompson plays, you should get the sack. An ordinary fan, actually, if Strachan or O'Neill was sitting there, would reword it and say, tell me why you don't play McGeady more and why you play Thompson instead of McGeady. And they would word it in that way. But it would be the way the fans want it. And so the fans couldn't complain. And the manager would then directly answer the points that the fans want answered.
Mm. It's how the question is delivered. It's the most important part of that role is the question.
Mm-hmm.
And it's how you deliver it. Hence why my questions were always thought out and were always discussed prior to sitting down with Gordon Strachan. And if there was a question which was slightly controversial, let's say, I would explain my reasonings for asking that question. And I reminded him that the fans want to know,
mm-hmm.
and they have a right to know. And I think, to Gordon's great credit, no matter what people think of Gordon, whether you love him or you hate him, I believe he always respected the opinion of the fans and always knew that without the fans, he wouldn't be there. He knew that. And I strongly believe that. Why do you think he speaks so highly of Celtic? He loves Celtic.
He does.
I defy anybody to tell me that man does not love Celtic Football Club.
He does. And actually, I just before we started this podcast, I was on, and there was a debate about comments that Frank McAvaney's made about the current team and setup.
And, saw that.
Yeah.
And, nonsense.
Correct. For a start, it's that anecdotal thing of forgetting that when he played at Celtic, the average attendance was in the mid-20s, thousands. Yeah. But somebody then made a comment of Gordon Strachan never, ever says something negative about Celtic. And if he frames any point about Celtic, it's always in a fashion where it's a constructive criticism. With the criticism so thinly in there that it's difficult to notice.
Yeah.
And I know Strachan had a mixed reception among Celtic fans while he was Celtic manager, partly down to, for those of us of a certain age, he had... a guy jumped out of the jungle and tried to attack him when he played for Aberdeen. Partly because I would say at times he had a pragmatic style of football as Celtic manager.
Yes.
But I always felt, I vividly remember he understood the fans. I vividly remember coming back from a Celtic game and him being interviewed about the cup. It was a cup draw.
Mm.
And the first thing he said was, "What idiot decided to do this? This cup draw has happened while the fans are in travelling home.
Mm-hmm.
Half the fans don't even know what the draw is because they've not got access to the television to see the draw on the television. Why did you have this draw at this time when the fans are on?" And I thought he was immediately thinking from a fan's perspective of the people who pay his wages. Out of all the people in football I hear talking, he's the one that seems to most understand the fans pay his wages.
There was a, I'll never forget, there was a Scottish League Cup draw. And the broadcaster made a derogatory comment, sort of a sexual innuendo about the balls on the draw. Now, we were down to interview Gordon the next morning to get his reaction to the draw. And I remember watching it and going, "Oh, God, that's not really called for." When the gentleman made the comment, I just thought it was smutty. Gordon came in, and let me tell you, he was absolutely raging. So he went into his, he said to me, "I'll give me 5 minutes." I said, "No problem." We went into the boardroom, we set up, he came through and he sat down. He said, "Did you see that last night? Did you see that? What was he doing? How dare he? How dare he say that before the watershed and also to belittle our beloved Scottish League Cup? What is he doing?" And he says, "When I see him, I will tear strips off him." We had a press conference that afternoon, and I turned around to my cameraman and went, "I really hope he comes to that press conference today." And he did. And before the press conference started, it's the funniest double take I've ever seen when Gordon spotted him, first of all, in the front row. And Gordon tore strips off him. And the broadcaster said, "There's a time and a place, Gordon. We should be discussing this elsewhere." And Gordon said, "Not a bloody chance. We're discussing this right here and now because you are a disgrace." And he was. Gordon cares so much about our game. He is so passionate about our game. And I fully endorsed everything that he said to that broadcaster because it was appalling.
So patently, your time at Celtic TV, one of the things you loved about that was meeting Gordon Strachan. Now, we all like to think Celtic are the greatest team in the world, but you'll obviously think that Aberdeen are the greatest team in the world. And you talked at the beginning about having great hope and expectation for the future. So,
yeah,
what is that hope and expectation that you've got for Aberdeen?
Do you know, all of a sudden, currently speaking, you know, we're now 2 points behind you and going into Saturday's game, we can go above you in the league. And all of a sudden, the expectations have just risen. Now, I'm not saying for 1 minute that we're going to go on and win the league, because I'm not stupid enough to make such a sweeping statement. But that all of a sudden, there's a belief. You know, I experienced it with the cup final last March. I went home to go to the cup final, and there was this feeling amongst the people of the city of Aberdeen that I had not felt, not experienced for many, many, many years. You could feel it in the media. You could feel it amongst the fans. You could just feel it in general that maybe, just maybe, we're on the cusp of doing something a little bit special, and that Derek is getting us back to where we as Aberdeen fans want to be. Now, I'm a realist. We are not going to win the league season in, season out. We're not going to win cups season in, season out. Mm-hmm. For me, it's about competing. For me, it's about making the Scottish Premiership competitive. And if we need an Aberdeen, we need a Dundee United, we need these teams to compete and to give Celtic competition. Now that we are giving you that competition, I think with the turn of the year, it's going to be very interesting to see how the players of Celtic, Aberdeen, Dundee United all react to the pressure, because it is about pressure. And all of a sudden, I think there's more pressure on Celtic than there is on Aberdeen and Dundee United, because Celtic are expected to win. Celtic are expected to win it by a country mile. The manager is expected to win it by a country mile. And I'm going to be really intrigued to see how they handle that pressure. And I just hope, I really hope Aberdeen have got the balls to show the bottle. Because for me, it's about bottle. It's about belief. And it's about getting over that line. For too many years, for me, Aberdeen have bottled it. They've just simply bottled it. When we've had opportunities to push, when we've had opportunities to get to cup finals, when we've had opportunities to give the fans something to cheer about, they've simply bottled it. I am not convinced that we're going to bottle it this year. I'm not saying we're going to win the league, first and foremost. Let's make that quite clear. I'm not saying we're going to win the league, but I think we can push it. And I'm going to be intrigued to see how far we can push it. I think we can win a cup. I fancy us for the League Cup again. And I hope to God we meet you in the final. I really want to meet Celtic in the final, because I think I'd have so much fun with all the pals that I've made from my days at Celtic TV, you know, on websites and on my Twitter and Facebook. I just want to have fun because, you know, I have such fun with you guys, and I love the fact that I've built a friendly relationship with you guys. That just, for me, it's about fun. It's just about fun.
One of the things I would say that what Aberdeen in particular this season are proving to me, because the guy next to me on Saturday was bemoaning how close Aberdeen and Dundee United are to us.
Yeah.
And my point actually was, he misunderstood the at first. My point was that you would be ahead of Celtic at this point 2 seasons ago, this season, because, and Celtic ended up winning the league by 15 points. Point being, I've always believed that part of the problem in Scottish football is by reducing the league to a 10 or 12 team league, when Rangers used to exist, that... Yeah. Exactly. Aberdeen, for example, if you're not quite at the races, and a lot of football's about belief and momentum, you after 4 games you play us and you lose. So you're immediately 3 points off both of Celtic and Rangers. Then you go on a 3-game, 4-game winning run, and then you play Rangers and you lose. Mm. So you're now 6 points behind, plus you've lost twice already inside the first 9 games of the season.
Yeah.
Whereas if you had a bigger league, you could go 10 games without playing Celtic or Rangers and go on a 7-game winning run.
Mm.
And the lack of Rangers is then giving you that opportunity to do that.
Yeah. For me, at the end of the day, I don't understand why there's a fear, or why there was a fear of facing Celtic and Rangers. It's 11 against 11 at the end of the day. And it's down to how the individual performs. Do your job first and foremost. There was a fear factor. I always believed there was a fear factor, especially when we went to Celtic Park. I just never understood it. It was like we were engulfed by what Celtic Park was all about. We were frightened. We were scared of the atmosphere. We were scared of Celtic Park. Why be scared? Embrace it, for goodness sake. It's why you've become professional football players. Isn't playing at Celtic Park all about being a professional football player. Mm-hmm. What was Paolo Maldini said? You've not experienced anything unless you've played at Celtic Park. Embrace the challenge. Take it on. Take it forward. Prove to your fans that you can handle the pressure. Prove to your peers that you can handle the pressure. I never understood it. It's 11 against 11 on the pitch at the end of the day. And it's whoever wins the tactical and personal battle on the pitch. You know, when we lost at Bitoji to the injury time goal, I was absolutely devastated because I thought, here we go again. We just bottle it every time against 10 men. On the day, you can argue we should have come away with a point, if not 3 points. And we bottled it at the end. Celtic go down to 10 men and we go into our shelves. I just couldn't believe it. We need to have a competitive league. We need it. I'm sick and tired of people making fun of the Scottish Premiership. Even out here, I'm pushing it all the time. And people are just, you know, the amount of mocking that I take from my colleagues who just think it's a diddy league, not interested in it, the ratings will be poor, nobody's going to be watching it, nonsense. I'm trying to push it as much as I possibly can. I'm quite active on my Twitter about it. You know, if your fans are Dundee United and Celtic, the game's live on this channel. Aberdeen, get amongst it, we're going to be live on this channel. If you want to watch Ross County against Dundee, get across it, it's on this channel. I'm trying to push it as much as I can. I'm as passionate as anybody about a football club, my own football club, but I'm also passionate about Scottish football.
And one of the things I think that Fergie did so well at Aberdeen, and I comment that if Aberdeen were playing in England, I think they're a mid-table Premiership team. They have the potential to. They're bigger than Swansea. They're bigger than teams like Blackburn and Middlesbrough, who've held their own in the Premiership for a while.
Yeah,
and I felt that Fergie was able to garner that feeling within the town of Aberdeen. And your point about the inferiority, you're actually being a one-team town of 200,000 people in Aberdeenshire with a further population of 250,000 people and only one other team in it. You have the potential to have 500,000 people behind the team of Aberdeen.
Yeah. Shall I tell you what I think the problem is? And I'll hold my own on this, and I've always believed this. I think because we've been through so much pain in 30 years, and there is so much expectation. When Aberdeen put themselves in a position to do that extra bit special, to get to, as I mentioned before, to get to a cup final, to push Celtic and then Rangers when they were back in the league, we failed. And we failed miserably. The Queen of the South Scottish Cup semi-final is the perfect example. When we sold out Hampden Park, we took nearly 25,000, 30,000 fans down for a semi-final, and Aberdeen got beat comfortably by Queen of the South because Queen of the South were up for it more than Aberdeen.
Yeah.
And Aberdeen fans who have gone through my experiences by winning so much, it's almost to the point where we just can't handle it. It's too painful. And I know some people may think I'm being a drama queen, but I'm telling you, unless you've experienced it, you're not in a position to argue because it's painful. I don't know if Aberdeen fans can continue to go through the amount of disappointment that we've been through in the past 30 years. When we put ourselves on the cusp of doing something good, we let ourselves down. But I now think that is in the past. I think we can get over the line. I really do. And I really hope we do. Because, do you know what? I know this sounds terribly selfish, but I deserve it. Me as a fan, I deserve it because I've given my life to that football club. I've cried for that football club. I've bled for that football club. And I deserve it as a fan. I deserve those boys to get over the line and do something special. And by God, I hope it happens this season. And let me tell you, see if it does, I will be on the fans' websites like a gun out of a bullet.
Well, suffice to say, I hope you don't. I have kept you long enough. We've been on this for some time. And This has been fascinating, and I could be on for anybody listening. Apologies that we're ending now, because I could be on for another hour, but both Ali and I have got other things to do. So I would suggest that people get your book, Beg to Differ. How can they get that?
You can get it via the usual route. So you can get it on Amazon. You can get it via Waterstones. Mm-hmm. And you can also get it via my own publisher, which is called Rudling House. They have their own website, and you can get it on there as well.
Okay, I'll have a link to, I'm sure I'll be able to find it on Amazon or somewhere like that. So I'll have a link to that on the podcast. But it's been really enlightening. I understand how you've been successful, because you have
a
forceful personality in terms of driving yourself forward. That's evident in our chat today. So that's been fantastic. So Ali Beg, thanks very much.
Our pleasure. I loved every minute of it. Thank you.
Cheers.
Smile, a never-lasting smile. More to this world, more than you can see. We'll find our destiny. I want all you've got to give. It's got to be more to this world. I know you'll stay. Don't throw it all away, away, away. I'm looking out for deep.
I'm sure you enjoyed that. Apologies for one or two blips in the middle of that, but I'm sure you appreciate. He's in Doha, I'm in Glasgow. We are about 4,500 miles apart, so the wonders of modern technology, they can get to speak so clearly at all, never mind with one or two blips there. We could have spoken for hours. We actually were on the Skype call for an hour and a half and could have been on for twice or three times as long. Very interesting. If you want to get his book, Beg to Differ, it's available, as he says, in many places. There's a link. If you go online, there's a link as to how you can acquire this on Amazon. .co.uk.com or wherever you are in the world listening to it. May I just take this time to wish you a happy new year, and hopefully there will be some more interesting podcasts. Meantime, I'll leave you with some music, and I'm sure you can guess who it is. This is me, Harry Brady, saying happy new year and good night. Good night.
We will always be together. I can see we are learning, because the passion is burning. Throw it out the old way.